Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie, of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss, of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Hello, welcome back to Fighting on Film. Now this week, don't despair, don't cry, I hear your cries. Merc Month 2 is over.
We
have one more film to do, and it's the Patreon pick that was an open vote. What a film they've chosen, yeah. It was an open vote. I think we had like 30, 40 votes on it. And it is 1998's Ronin.
Yep. It's over on our Patreon page. Every month we allow the supporting cast to give us a hand and pick a film for us to cover. And if you're interested in supporting the podcast, that's a great way to do it and interact and help us pick a film every month. But before we dive into one of the best casts of a mid-90s action movie, Rob's actually, you know, he's turned a bit mercenary and he's working on another podcast. Aren't you, Rob?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. Nice way to segue there, Matt. That's nice.
I told you I had something.
Yeah, so I am part of a new podcast called the Homefront History Podcast with Andy Chatterton and Chris Colonco. And every week we are going to be talking about Homefront history. So in the first episode, we talk about American weapons for the Home Guard that were donated by the civilians. And we're going to be doing pillboxes, rationing, anything Homefront you can think of. We're going to be trying to cover it.
So yeah, episode was great. Listen to it this morning. Really interesting.
Oh, thanks. And you can find us on HFH History, so all one word, on Twitter. And you can listen to us on Spotify and iTunes and Acast. So yeah, if any FOF fans want to go and give us some support, I'd much appreciate that.
Yeah, looking forward to more.
Thanks. So maybe then we should jump off and get into that cast you were talking about.
Well, we've got to start with Bobby D. There's not many films we can cover that have Robert De Niro as the lead or in them, generally speaking.
Yeah.
This is obviously one of Robert De Niro's more notable action movies from the 90s, the other being Heat, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
But he plays Sam, an American mercenary, formerly associated with the CIA. Spoilers, it later turns out that he's not actually formally associated. He actually is still in the CIA. Ooh. Mind blown towards the end of the film.
Mind games.
So just to run down some of, you know, De Niro's notable films out of the I don't know.
You don't know any De Niro films. Now. Where the fuck have you been?
I know. So Taxi Driver, The Deer Hunter, which you mentioned before on the podcast, Godfather Part 2, The Mission, Untouchables, Heat, Jackie Brown, Men of Honor, Shark Tale, Little Fockers, The Intern, Dirty Grandpa.
He's had a decade where he just did a bit of everything. So he, like 70s is gritty. 80s is like sort of becoming more box office profitable. 90s is actioners mainly, I think.
Yes, yeah.
And
yeah,
more comedic roles. And then as he does these comedic roles in the late 90s, he goes full-blown comedy for some reason. He's having a whale of a time.
He's a renaissance man. He can do it
he
all.
He really is, yeah. And this is in his renaissance that he had with Al Pacino at the same kind of time. They had a 90s renaissance, I think.
They did. Yeah, it's true. Backing him up is Jean Reno, who plays Vincent, a French. He's kind of he's sort of like the guy that gets the kits. He's
a fixer.
He's a fixer. He is a dab hand with firearms. He's a good driver. He's kind of the everyman,
like a wheelman, but not kind of.
Yeah, because we've got Larry as the wheelman, but we'll come to him in a moment. The director, Frankenheimer, was very keen that Reno and De Niro have on-screen like friend chemistry to the max.
Yeah. It's one of the strongest things this movie. They really have great.
And it does it really well. Like the we'll probably talk about this scene a little bit later on, where the various members of the team meet for the first time. And even in that first scene, there's great chemistry between the two of them.
Mm.
Of course, Renault's known for Leon. He was Mufasa in the French dub of The Lion King. If you didn't
amazing.
Know that,
Rob. Wow.
Yeah. And in the more recent live action version as well.
Wow.
Yeah. Mission Impossible in 1996, Hotel Rwanda in 2004, Flyboys in 2006, The Roundup in 2010. He was in Defy Bloods in 2020. And he was also in the French Sweeney remake as well.
Oh, wow. Okay. Didn't know they had all those.
They did.
Was that before or after the Ray Winston one?
They essentially made a French version of the Winston 2012 film that they made.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting.
Wasn't great, that film. It wasn't awful.
No, it didn't really lead anywhere, did it?
I've just got to say, before we talk about war movies, obviously, but before we move on, I've got to say how Jean Reno hasn't yet been cast to play De Gaulle is beyond me. He would look really great.
He could play
an
elderly
role.
De Gaulle right now. Yeah. He's still got the look of him. Then we've got Natasha McElhone, who plays Deirdre, who is a Irish and later revealed to be an IRA operative, who commissions the team and brings them together to steal. It's a briefcase, but we don't really find out what's in the box/briefcase.
No. It's a MacGuffin, isn't it?
It is. And we'll talk about that later on towards the end, I think.
What's in the box?
So she's in cahoots with Seamus O'Rourke, who is played by Jonathan Pryce. Pryce has had a long stage and screen career. Glengarry Glen Ross, got to mention that one because Rob loves that film in 92.
I adore that film. Yeah.
Tomorrow Never Dies in 97, New World in 2005, the Pirate of the Caribbean movies, and most recently he's been in The Crown. But back to Natasha, who plays Deirdre. She was also playing an Irish lady in The Devil's Own in 1997, I believe, if I remember right. It's been a while since I saw that film. She was also in The Truman Show, of course, lots of TV. Most recently, she's been in Halo and The Crown, along with Jonathan Pryce. Rounding out the cast of the mercenaries or the team, we've got Stellan Skarsgård, who plays Gregor, who is a sort of ex-East German, possibly KGB, Stasi type.
Just a bad bastard in this, isn't he?
He is. He plays it brilliantly. And he's kind of shown in the film during the mission phase to be the tech guy. He's setting up the GPS. He's got the computer. It's a giant,
the world's chunkiest laptops ever.
CRTV.
Yeah.
CRT like monitor. And he's there with his.
So Matt wouldn't have seen this in because he didn't, I don't think he had the DVD, he watched it digitally. I watched a making of featurette, and Skarsgård says that he made a backstory for his character of the guy was in the KGB. He was a very abandoned bad person.
Wasn't it?
Abandoned his family. Oh, I didn't know if you'd seen that. See, he said that it's,
I did my research.
Yeah, thank you. That's all right. Just in case you hadn't, I didn't know if it was online or not. Because that's why we get the, you know, we got the DVD collection here at FOF HQ to watch these featurettes, because you sometimes just can't find them.
That's very true.
But yeah, no, his whole backstory that he put to the character was fantastic.
Yeah, I believe Frankenheimer was, you know, really impressed with the depth that he gave the character, and you don't get all of that in the film. There's a couple of little scenes where, you know, like De Niro knocks a coffee cup off and he catches it.
Yeah.
It's like good reflexes and that kind of thing.
It's good. There's a lot of nuance going on, a lot of background stuff going on.
Oh, there is an awful lot of nuance, especially in those initial scenes where they set up the characters.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite scenes. Spoilers.
Well, great. We'll talk more about it later.
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of Swedish film work. Hunt for Red October in 1990. Good Evening, Mr. Wallenberg. And Saviour in 1998. Saviour being a film about Bosnia with Dennis Quaid. Very interesting. Looks like a future one for the show, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Railway Man in 2013. Most notably, Chernobyl, the HBO series in 2019. And most recently, Andor, the Star Wars Insurgency series coming off the back of Rogue One.
I think he pops up in The Avengers as well, doesn't he? It's the guy with the Tesseract.
He might well do. He might well do. I mean, with all of these actors, there's just too much to...
They're huge. It's a huge ensemble.
Just trying to give a little taste of the breadth and, you know, some of the interesting things they've done, you know, like De Niro in Shark Tale and the Little Fockers.
Just don't mention the deer hunter. He didn't even mention the deer hunter. Amazing. I'm going to pretend you didn't, so it's more funny to me.
All right, fine. Sean Bean as Spence, a character who is really played beautifully by Bean, I think. It's really understated. He's the Englishman who sort of claims to be 22 SAS, leading to one of the more iconic scenes from this film.
Oh.
My headcanon for this is he's actually a really low-level British intelligence agent who has been forced to go on this mission. But we'll talk a bit more about that later on when we talk about how...
Because I think he is
Neo's character evolves and Renault's character evolves, I think. Because I have a headcanon.
Yeah, because I think he might be ex-SAS, but I think he might have been invalided out.
No, I think the way that De Niro deconstructs him and the way he acts shows that he has very little military experience whatsoever.
Okay.
So I think my read on him without my headcanon is he's probably what's known as a Walt or a Walter Mitty, where he's just pretending he was in the military in order to get on these kind of jobs.
I can see that as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
They totally see
that.
That's
my read. He might have been in for a very brief time, and he might have been in TA or something. Wasn't. Yeah, who knows? Not disparaging the TA, obviously, but...
No, of course not.
Just to round out some of Sean's quite impressive career, actually. When you look at his filmography, it's like, okay, like that's quite impressive.
He's
become
a bit
impressive.
Of a meme over the years, I think, hasn't he?
Because for all the characters that die, isn't it?
But he's such an accomplished actor. He's very good.
I saw him in Time recently, BBC
series.
That was
fabulous. That was
with
one of
Stephen
his
Graham.
So great. Good. Yeah.
Yeah. His reactions to, you know, some of the terrible things that go on inside prison were amazing. Anyway, way off the point, but you know, Patriot Games in 1992, GoldenEye in 1995, Bravo 2-0, which we've covered on the pod, Equilibrium in 2002, National Treasure in 2004, Troy, the Sharp series in the 90s. Age of Heroes in 2011, and a very unusual film called Soldiers of Fortune in 2012, which has an amazing like premise where there's a group of war tourists who pay money to be protected, but also to be soldiers in a war zone on like a holiday. It's kind of like Westworld, but in real life, or in the real world, I should say. And it has an incredible cast. It's like... Colin Meaney's in there. Ving Rhames pops up. It's such a bizarre cast. But
you mean
it looks...
Cole Meany, the aeroplane pilot from Die Hard 2?
That's him. Windsor Airlines. You know him.
Yeah.
Then we got Skip Suduth, who plays Larry. And he's the wheelman. He's the getaway driver. He's the man that knows how to handle an Audi S8. Yes. Throws it in the corners like a motherfucker. And apparently he did a lot of the driving. So obviously we'll talk a bit more about how all that stunt work was done later on, because it's quite interesting. But apparently he did a lot of the driving himself as well. Lots of TV and lots of 90s movies predominantly. Mm. And he's had a long TV career, lots of CSI and those kind of NCIS shows of more recently. Right in the cast out, we have a nice little appearance from Michael Lonsdale, who is probably his best known character is Drax from Moonraker, the Bond movie in the 70s. Especially to me anyway, but he's had a super long career, spanning from the 60s right through to the 2010s. Is Paris Burning, Day of the Jackal in 1972, The Passage, Moonraker, as I mentioned, The Bunker with Anthony Hopkins as Hitler, a really interesting take on that story in 1981, Smiley's People in 1982, and Munich in 2005. So some interesting spy-orientated kind of movies. And then we've got Fedor Atkin, who plays Mickey, who's the Russian oligarch character who wants to buy the case, the MacGuffin case.
He's in for like 5 minutes.
He is, but he has a nice scene with Gregor, which I think reacts really well, Skarsgård's character.
Yeah.
Again, one of his early credits was Day of the Jackal. He was in Operation Orgrow, in 1979. He was Duco in the Sharp series. He played a bastard in the Sharp series a number of times. He was in Spy Games in 1999. He had a small role in World War Z in 2013. And he's done a lot of French dubbing. So I think he is one of the guys that dubs Tommy Lee Jones in a lot of films in French market. Yeah. Very interesting. And that kind of rounds out the cast for this week. It's a small cast comparatively to some of these films we've looked at throughout Merc Month, but it's again really well formed. Really great actors in there.
Yeah, it really reminds me of Heat. How you've just got a fantastic, really tight knit ensemble.
Mm.
And there's also a cameo of sorts that you missed. So right near the end of the film, there's a girl screaming for her mother. When they evacuate the ice rink.
Oh, the little girl, yeah.
Little girl. And that girl is the same little girl who is in Saving Private Ryan when Capazzo gets shot, trying to help her.
Oh, right. Trying to save
that little
girl.
Yeah. Nice little cameo there. Just thought I'd mention it.
Great.
We've had quite a non-war movie month. Let's try and keep it on track. Into production. So the film is directed by the legendary John Frankenheimer. Born in 1930 in Queens, New York City, cut his teeth learning his trade in the Air Force Film Squadron in the early 50s. And then his first feature is The Young Stranger. It was released in 1957. He then goes on to garner huge critical acclaim for The Manchurian Candidate in 1962. Mm-hmm. He then goes on to direct Burt Lancaster for the lead in his 1964 film, The Train, which is we must cover that at some point. It's an incredible film.
It's a must for train month.
Must for train. Christ, man, all these months we're trying to do. My word. and later in the same decade, he directs a film called Grand Prix, which was his first.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was his first film for MGM or cinema. No, hang on. I'll cut that shit. It's not in my notes. So he directs a film called Grand Prix in 1966. And this is where he sort of cements his reputation for doing these driving stunts and like epic in-camera driving sequences. He mentions this a lot in the PR for Ronin, that it's like, oh, I learned my trade doing this on Grand Prix, and then I used it in the French Connection 2 sequel in 1975. And they're talking about his later work there. He directs a 1990 war film called The Fourth War, where two men have a fight on a border and it could spark a war. That's like an interesting film to cover later. And this Ronin, when it comes out in 1998, it's seen as like a bit of a career resurgence for Frankenheimer, who had been doing, he had not been making films, but they definitely hadn't been the height of his career like it had in the 60s. So he signs on to direct this film for MGM. And he said at the time, and this is from a book called Pictures About Extremes, Films of John Frankenheimer from 2008. And he says, it seemed like a good thing to work on. I like the characters. I like the idea there were these professional people without real attachments anymore. I like the fact that the action sequences came out of what the characters did rather than just one of these arbitrary things that you see all the time. And I love the fact that it took place in France.
Yeah, he made a lot of films in France, didn't he?
Really did, yeah. He says that in that featurette that I mentioned. It's like, oh, it was in France. I almost jumped at the chance.
Frankenheimer making just three demands from the studio. I need Paris in the winter, Robert De Niro, and a fuckload of guns, and maybe a car or two.
Yeah. How many Audis have you got? Double it, and I'm in. So it's written by J.D. Zeke and David Mamet. Zeke's credits include Witchblade in 2000 and Pistol Whipped, which is a 2008 Steven Seagal straight-to-DVD film. So a nice mention of Seagal there. But David Mamet is a screenwriter, famous for, you mentioned Glengarry Glen Ross with Jonathan Pryce, but he wrote Glengarry Glen Ross in 1992.
Ah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to say it again, I adore that film. 1997's Wag the Dog, which is a Robert De Niro film about a manufactured war, or a war being manufactured to save a presidency, which is, it seems interesting. And then Hannibal in 2001. And then he was the lead writer on the 2006 series, The Unit, which is like the American Ultimate Force. If you remember that one.
Oh, yeah. That does ring a bell.
Mm. The cinematography was by Frenchman Robert Frasse, or Frace. And he worked on the 1995 film Wings of Courage, which was the first drama film to be shot in IMAX. And he also worked on 7 Years in Tibet, 2001's Enemy at the Gates as well. So it's quite an accomplished cinematographer there. And I think the cinematography in this is more than competent. It does exactly what it needs to do.
Yeah. Got lovely shots. Some nice little cars, isn't there?
Yeah. Really, some really great tight knit action sequences that need to be filmed in a certain way. And Frace, you know, gets it right. And the score is by Elia Smiril. He's a Czech composer. And his most notable credits for me were Battlefield Earth in 2000, that stinker, we can all agree. Mm. And then he just does a lot of horrors, so like The Wrong Turn, Piranha 3D, among others. Quite a career there. And the film's stunt coordinator was Joe Dunn, and he worked on Frankenheimer's next feature after Ronin, which was 2000's Reindeer Games. But he also served as a fight coordinator on 6 episodes of The Professionals in the 70s.
No way. Love
it. He did, yeah. And he was uncredited for his work on stunts in The Eagle Has Landed, A Bridge Too Far, and Kelly's Heroes.
Very cool. Nice.
Yeah, very nice there. And the stunt drivers was an F1 driver called Jean-Pierre Jarier and professional driver Jean-Claude Lagniez, who did the 2 Le Mans races in the 70s, and Belgian driver Michel Newgarden, who won the G2 Le Mans race in 1997, driving a Porsche, which is quite interesting. So, you know, that they got all the guys in to do the driving. You knew they had to get the right people in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and those three guys are more than competent. And they look the part in that feature. If anyone can find it on YouTube, but they look cool as these drivers. You know, it's just so easy for them to do this type of thing. It's really funny. And Frankenheimer said this about the stunt driving. It's from the same book that I mentioned earlier. He said, "We had great drivers and we did some shots with the actors in real cars during the scenes. I got the English right-hand drive versions of the cars we were going to shoot. That way we could have the stunt driver on the right driving the car and a phony steering along the left for actors so we could photograph the actors driving the cars."
I love De Niro. De Niro's I'm driving fast acting face.
He pushes himself back in his chair like he's on amazing. Mac 10 or Mac Force, doesn't he?
Yeah.
You know.
He's like
what, he's going at warp speed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So good.
Love and there's it. Also a thing they did where they would have the boot of a car, or for Americans, the trunk, would be hollowed out, and they would build a second steering wheel inside, and a stunt driver could like drive the car on top of the car. So then you'd have I think Skip mentioned in that featurette that you'd be sat in the car and there'd be like a piece of metal over the foot pedals, and the car would be driven for you, and you just had to act like you were doing it. And he was like,
that's hard in itself, exactly. Making it look realistic. And these guys, I think everyone that drives in the film does a pretty good job of making it look realistic.
Mm. And I think that's something that obviously, you know, Frankenheimer had learned his trade on Grand Prix and French Connection. Mm. So ex-22 SAS member Mick Gould acted as the film's technical advisor, and he assisted with weapons training and close quarter fighting. And he's worked on Heat, The Long Kiss Goodnight, Miami Vice remake in 2006, Equalizer 2, Collateral. Yeah, really famous in the industry. We should try and get him on. Seems like a really interesting chap.
Yeah, it'd be great to chat to, wouldn't it?
Interesting, yeah. The production company was United Artists. It was distributed by MGM, a budget of $55 million. The box office, it got $70.7 million. So it made its money back, but wasn't a huge box office smash, but it was like critically well received as well. So it was kind of a moderate hit, I'd say.
Yeah.
But not in a disparaging way. It just didn't make it as much money as MGM would have liked, I don't think.
Yeah. It's obviously not achieved the same sort of cult level as Heat.
No, but it's got its, I think it's its own little niche.
It definitely does have its niche. I agree. I think, you know, it doesn't have that pairing of Pacino and De Niro. So it's never going to hit those levels of following.
Yeah.
But I think it's up there. This is a hell of a film.
It's like, it's for me, it's Heat's in the same conversation as Ronin, and Ronin's in the same conversation as Heat. They feel like spiritual successes.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's like a spiritual success to me.
So it's filmed in late 1997 into early 1998, and it was released in the US in September the 25th of the same year, and it was released in the UK in November 1998. And the film, as I said, it was well received for its stunts and action sequences. Siskel and Ebert on their show, you know, they said it was more than worth a watch at the time. And I have a retro review from the New York Times from the 25th of September 1998. And I'll just read you a little extract from a review by Janet Maslin. She says, a crew of tough customers assemble at the start of John Frankenheimer's top-notch thriller, Ronin. Each of them is a seasoned and shrewd veteran, but they've got nothing on the man behind the camera when it comes to gritty professionalism. Directing like a world-weary Hitchcock with a taste for the breathtaking car chase, Frankenheimer propels this tale of intrigue through its tightly plotted paces with such conviction that he makes an action hero out of Robert De Niro. During this film's moments of fierce tension, I watched viewers in an early screening quite literally biting their nails.
Wow.
It was a very positive review. In fact, all the reviews I read were very positive indeed.
See why?
Yeah.
I remember watching it as a kid when it first came on TV, which probably would have been like, probably around 2000 when this probably hit British TV for the first time. If it came out in 98.
I'd say so.
Normally a couple of years, isn't it? But I remember it being on like BBC or something like that late night, and being really impressed. Be like, ooh.
Very fun film. Can imagine teenage Matt being like, yeah. So in terms of what you guys thought, we had another amazing response to the one word review. We had 142 likes on the post, and we had over 100 responses, and I think maybe 70% of them were you guys going Hereford or Hereford. You know, doing De Niro's impression. So I'll just read some of them out. So Rob Shipman goes with Boathouse. Dan McClinton says 45 APC. Jonathan Ware says Convoy. Snarky Poster says Improbable. Sean Bean lives. Jem Dudaku says Solid. The World at War goes with Awesome. Dominic Adler says Shovel. And Monty the Horse goes with Brilliant. And to end another one, Chris Turner goes with Boathouse. There were so many Boathouse.
A lot of Boathouses. That's one of the iconic scenes in this film, though. I mean...
It is.
I don't want to drop Rob in it, but he hadn't seen it before we did the podcast.
No. It was on Netflix when I went to uni, and I was like, right, I'll put that in my watch. And by the time I got to it, it had been taken off Netflix.
So it's like, it's one of the iconic scenes that you know, a lot of people joke about, a lot of people quote, is, you know, what colour is the boathouse at Hereford?
And I didn't know what that meant until this film. And I was like, oh, it's from this. So from colours of boathouses at Hereford to this week's Alley Telly.
It's time for Alley Telly on Fighting on Film.
Well, what can you say? It's a car and a gun movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Some really interesting stuff. And it's at that mid-90s point where not everything's an AR-15 yet and not everything's a Glock yet.
We're not in a sea of like M4 carbines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get some really cool, interesting stuff.
I think because it's filmed in Europe, you have a more interesting pool of weaponry to pull from.
Yeah, that's fair to say. That's certainly fair to say. Lots of Berettas, lots of six-hour pistols, lots of FN Mini-Me pops up.
Yeah, Robert De Niro getting out of that car with an FN Mini-Me and absolutely letting rip on that convoy. It's one of the most iconic scenes for me in all cinema.
He really does level.
I was not expecting him to get out of that car with a Mini-Me.
And he looks
great.
He looks good with it. Like, he really does lay it down.
I like to think that he was in NAM or Grenada or something. Like, he was doing covert stuff at one point.
Yeah, before
career.
He got recruited to the CIA kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Like, he could be like an ex-SEAL or something. Like, I just feel like, because his drills are immaculate for the character anyway. His drills are immaculate. Yeah. So it really sort of...
Gould did his work.
Yeah, there's a lot of intrigue with his character there.
The gunplay in the film is you know, pretty realistic. You know, there's some reloads in there, which not that many 90s films bother with. I mean, Heat obviously did, but I think Mick was involved with Heat as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, yeah. Yeah.
Because he has that through line with Man through Miami Vice and Collateral, obviously. I remember watching a behind the scenes featurette from Collateral with Mick Gould in doing the training with Tom Cruise.
Yes.
And the preciseness that they went to with that, with the drills.
Mm.
So I can certainly see them doing the same thing with De Niro and, you know, Renault and the other characters.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it all comes across really well. And that, you know, like the guns sound punchy. You hear ricochets. You know, there's big flashes of guns, and it looks really good on screen. But to be fair, the gun part of this movie is quite small. There's only two shootouts, really. And then I think there's people just firing guns at each other. They're not really pitched shootouts. I quite like that. And I think Sean Bean sums up Matt's profession in two lines, where he goes, "Old gun."
Yeah, so there's that scene where Sean's trying to bond with De Niro's character, and he's like, "So, what'd you carry?" I'm a weapons man. I'm a weapons guy."
Yeah,
and De Niro's like, "I don't know, the 1911."
I like the 1911. Yeah,
and De Niro says something like, "It served us well," and then Sean can try to rile him by going, "You've not done so well in the last couple of wars, have you?" Like, oh, Sean.
Right.
Trying to get a rise out of him. That's one of my favourite scenes where they all get to know each other.
I'll
probably talk about that
good.
In a moment.
Mm.
But one thing I do like about this film, before we talk about the inevitable cars, is the fact that everyone has a signature gun. So
they do, don't they? Yeah.
De Niro's got that 1911 we just mentioned. It's like a custom long slide 1911. Then you've got Skarsgård has a Glock 17L, the long slide Glock, which he kits out in a very alleyway.
Yeah.
Like cutting edge stuff for the mid 90s. You put like a Bushnell holosight on it, which is a massive red dot. the kind of size that is probably now too big for what you would see on a rifle, but it's on a pistol. Yeah. Now you can get like a red dot, which is about maybe an inch and a quarter, maybe seven or 8 centimeters long in the base, and they mill them directly onto the slide of the pistol now. But this has got this big, chunky, like
huge,
like raised mount.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
That slides over the frame, and then he puts in an extended Glock 18 magazine and a silencer.
Yeah, it's cool.
And it's a shame he doesn't get to use that more, because he just kind of scares a contact with it a little bit by threatening to shoot a child in a park, and then
that was dark.
By shooting
that's the
contact.
Really darkest part of the film. That was dark as I was like, oh god, he's gonna kill that poor girl.
Well, that's how they really nail down. Gregor's character, isn't it, that he's ruthless. John Renault's character Vincent is running a Beretta 92 FS in like chrome, which is a very 90s gun.
It's very cool. But John Renault in this movie just he reeks cool, doesn't he?
Oh yeah,
you know, he's without coming doubt. Off a professional, he's mm-hmm. smoking fags the entire way through.
Oh yeah, he's chain smoking his way through this.
Oh yeah,
Biff Bringer.
Yeah. He's the Monarch of the Marlborough in this film, he really is.
Price's Seamus is running a Sig P239, which is like a little pocket pistol. Yep. Really, quite an elegant pick. And then
Jonathan Price gets angry shooting people really well.
He does.
He's so sinister with it as well. Yeah. Blasts people away. I'm like, you can't just shoot your way out of trouble forever, John. You're going to damn well try.
There's a bit where later on in the film, De Niro, rejects the classic and accepts modernity and goes with a Sig P228. There's a scene in the amphitheater where I think one of the Russian dudes grabs a bystander, like a lady, and he takes a very long like shot where he just drops this dude with one shot.
Very cool. Yeah.
After being in a rough and tumble with Gregor.
Yeah. Hilfer, he's robbing me. He pushes him.
Yeah, it's very good.
That sequence annoyed me because,
really?
It might not have been noticeable in the early thousands on like a small CRT television, but now I'm on this like, my big 60-inch telly at home. I'm not trying to flex, but you know, everyone's got a big telly now, ain't they? So when Skarsgård stunt double jumps down off one of the stairwells, you can clearly tell it's not Skarsgård for a split second.
Yeah, his glasses fall off too.
Yeah, and then you can clearly tell it's not De Niro in some bits. Especially
there's a bit where he pops out of the car with the law.
It's a guy
it's
that's
definitely
like,
not De Niro, is it?
Like if De Niro takes like a large, this guy takes a medium. Like he's tiny, this dude that comes out of the car.
No, it's very true.
I like that.
That law's interesting,
like when you
actually.
Can sometimes see the stunt doubles briefly.
Yeah,
I love it.
It's a little bit of fun, isn't it? It's an extra level of, you get to try and spot the stunt double.
So talking about clothing there, I can't get over the fact that for me, I don't know if anyone else has thought this, but I couldn't work out who De Niro reminded me of in the first like half hour of the movie. Mm-hmm. He's dressed a little bit like Columbo. Did you know?
Oh, in his long overcoat.
I was just like, who does he look like? I was trying to think, and I was like, he looks like Columbo.
Flat cap.
I've got to pull up like an image of him and an image of Columbo for the Twitter and put it to a vote.
Who wore it better?
Who wore it better? Yeah, it's got to be that.
De Niro's got some looks in this film.
He really does.
A bit. he goes through a number of outfits, and there's a great bit where he has like a roll down. They go on like a recce to see to try and scope out the team guard in the box.
Yeah,
and he's wearing like this,
like an arms deal, isn't it?
Yeah, he's wearing it's at the hotel, and he's wearing this.
That's it. Sorry,
like roll neck jumper and like a tan blazer, and they're posing as rich people on holiday.
Mm. That's like a suede jacket, Matt. That's very 90s. Very like,
yeah. There's another bit where they're in one of the hideouts, one of the safe houses, and he's wearing this really nice little like stonewashed jeans / grey t-shirt / like dark green, forest green.
It's like your dad. Everyone's dad in the 90s.
And I'm like, oh,
it's everyone's dad in the 90s.
I didn't know I'd been unconsciously dressing like Robert De Niro in Ronin.
He's got
this time.
He's got his best Debenhams stonewash on. He's got his John Rosher jacket. He's loving life. Really alienate the American listeners there with Debenhams brands. And from
Debenhams with his F&F Grace t-shirt. F&F.
Yeah.
But so maybe let's move on to something a little bit more universal and talk about the cars. Because there's some really it's saloon cars getting thrown around like no one's
coupes
business.
And saloons, yeah. So I've got it in my notes. It's an Audi S8, then every Citroen and BMW saloon or coupe available in the late 90s is on screen at some point in this movie.
Yeah. Peugeot 406, like Citroen XMs. The Audi S8 that Larry asks for with the nitrous kit, which isn't used in the film, but I guess it's just used. It's not like a feature, it's just
no, obviously in a modern movie now, you get him like flicking the button and then going,
oh god, yeah.
Yeah, you'd get that, wouldn't you?
If we're watching Fast and the Furious 9, it would be like Larry hit the nitrous, and it'd be like a whole like little sequence of Larry hitting the nitrous.
He'd fly through the air a million miles an hour.
Yeah, and they'd have like a lasso, and they'd be swinging it around a tank or something. You know, some bollocks. And
it's got a bit weird, that series.
That Audi S8 is pure, it's pure elf dad. It's cool dad car, it's isn't it?
Prime Top Gear magazine mid-90s material. That's what it is.
Yes, it is. That's very true. I love the old Mercedes 450 SL, which they, I think Vincent and Sam jump into towards the end, like brown, just very classic Mercedes.
Yeah.
But it looks great.
It is cool. There's a cut car
there's an
as well.
M5 in there as well.
M5. Yeah. There's a cut bit in the alternative ending that was cut. But Deirdre attempts to drive away in a Fiat Punto right at the end, like a really early.
Oh, Alan's driving a Fiat Punto.
Like a really early Fiat Punto before they got all rounded.
Oh,
yeah. Really
one of those
ones. Yeah. Yes. And I was like, oh, I like that car. That was my favorite. That would have been my favorite car if it was still in the movie. Just because
there's a Golf at one point.
A Golf
as well.
Yeah.
I think Vincent hijacks a Golf, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's a proper car film. It's really like Bullet, but for the 90s.
Yeah, and they're really realistic. They don't show the cars doing anything outlandish. The cornering isn't, you know, overblown, or it's believable that they can drift an Audi S8 like that.
Yes, and that's I was going to bring that onto that this movie feels realistic. The things you're doing in this car feel like people could do it, you know. Yeah. It feels real, and I like the fact that when they're having these chases, these engines, they're screaming like they're being pushed. They're absolutely
smashing the rev limits.
Yeah, I love that though, because it's not like in Fast and the Furious where everyone's got like 100 odd gears on their car and their cars never worry about anything. They are really pushing these cars. And one last thing I've got to mention is, in lieu of a Bedford this week, we have a Leyland DAF.
I saw the DAF.
Over.
Yeah.
Saw I was like, DAF. Nice. I was like, whoa.
I know.
Obscure.
I think we should buy a Peugeot 406 from a scrapper
and
recreate some of these sequences.
Yeah. But talking about the
try and find a DAF.
Try and find a Leyland DAF, yeah. But there's a great thing in the featurette where it just shows the sort of competent filmmaking that that Frankenheimer was doing. So that when they flipped that BMW to make it go off the motorway, like I mentioned before, they only did that shot once. So it was meant to roll and skid on its back, or sorry, its back, its hood, and then fall off the road. But in the take, the guy rolled it and it slid for a little bit and then it flipped. So it was back on its wheels. And they were all worrying, they're going to have to reset it and, you know, are we going to have to get a new car and all that? Because 80 cars were used in this movie, which is incredible. And Frankenheimer is sitting there watching the rushes back and he goes, no, what we'll do is, and he's got all these people around him that they filmed at the moment. He goes, no, we'll cut to De Niro in the car and then we'll use the same car that's wrecked here and we'll push it off and we'll cut back. Don't have to do it again. The stunt driver is already dangerous. And it's that level of skill of a filmmaker just to go, no, we'll just do a cut there. Be fine.
Yeah. I love he knows what will look good. Yeah. He knows, he can make it work.
Really does. Yeah.
Really cool. Yeah. One thing I did read about the sound of the actual vehicles, because we've talked about, you know, the drivers and, you know, the cars that we used. I really like that they recorded all of the actual cars on a track and then mixed it down. And then when they were doing that last sequence, when they were in the edit, they looked at that and Frankenheimer listened to the score over it. And it clashed with the engine sounds and the external sounds and around the location. And they said, no, what we'll do is take the score out and just let it be the actual sound of the chase. And it works so well.
Wow. Yeah. Because that is one thing the movie does, where in the chase sequences, it holds back on its score. It just gives you the sound of the engines.
That's it.
It's so much.
People rave about Heat and, you know, shooting in, you know, the streets and giving that massive, having a sound.
Yeah, this movie is same cars, approach. What Heat is to firearms, is shootouts.
Yeah, you could say that, yeah. I mean, Heat's got some cool, you know, driving sequences, but I think if I've got it in my notes where I was probably thinking, you know, out loud, and I've got it's one of the best of the 90s. Definitely.
Oh yeah.
But it's also one of the best chase sequence films of all time. Like, I think there's something about those locations, the tight, narrow French Riviera streets, the sound design on them, the impressive driving skill, something about them, it all comes together into a package which is like, oh, this is professionals doing a really nice job at putting this piece of, you know, cinema together. And it feels like this is a car chase between people who know how to drive and have been professionally trained how to drive someone like De Niro would be, or, you know, someone who is trying to, you know, safeguard and defend a very, very valuable package of whatever hell it was in that briefcase.
Yeah, exactly. And that sort of echoes what I've got to say. One of my final thought points is that it does feel grounded in reality, where a different director would have gone a different route with it and probably had cars flying through the air every 5 minutes and probably would have had, you know, people having full-on firefights on top of their cars or something. Like, it in the wrong director's hands, this movie could have gone really overblown and really overcooked its action. But I don't think it does. I think it just straddles the edge there and it knows when to pull back. You know, cars feel weighty. Bullets, as we said, bullets hit and they punch. You know, the two squibs that Jonathan Pryce has, spoilers, he gets killed at the end by Jean Reno. But when he gets shot through the back, these squibs go off and you really feel like he's getting hit with these bullets. You know, it's powerful. Everything is for a reason.
One thing I did read about the shootout sequences, Frankenheimer was adamant that they wouldn't do any of that, you know, the in vogue 90s slow-mo gunfight stuff. He was adamant that everything would be in real time and that it would be as realistic as possible.
Yeah.
Just to give it that authenticity. And he felt that if you're going to depict violence, you should depict it in a way that doesn't, you know, make it look fake and cinematic.
No, I agree. Yeah, I do. And like, and maybe talking about scenes from the film, we should probably jump into favourite scenes because there's some doozies.
Hello there. Sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show. So Rob, what's your favourite scene?
So my favourite scene is all the parts with Sean Bean, because he's my favourite character in it, apart from De Niro and Renault, because they're just, their chemistry's on another level. But I like Sean Bean because he's acts so out of his depth. I mean, I know he said about his character that he does feel like he's out of his depth and he's not on the same level as these guys. But it's just, you get your classic Sean Beanisms in there. He calls people a bastard, which is great.
He shouts bastard while he's shooting, doesn't he?
He has probably one of my favourite greatest on-screen fuck-offs ever to Robert De Niro, where he's Robert De Niro is baiting him into sort of getting angry. And he's like, fuck off. It's great. And then when they have the firefight in there, they're getting out, and you can tell that this is probably Sean Bean's character's first firefight he's ever been in. Mm-hmm. So he's got this whole adrenaline rush, then he's sick, whereas the rest of them know how to handle it. But he's like, I thought we were going to be raspberry jam back there.
Oh, my God. Like,
it's such a weird line. But no, my favourite part of the movie is where De Niro susses him out before they do the actual heist of the briefcase. Mm-hmm. So De Niro has asked for money, more money, because he's like, look, we don't know what's in the briefcase. You won't tell us. We don't have any guy. Yeah. These guys are going to be heavily armed. I want more money. I want money in a bank account, and I want it, you know, 100K. And he gestures to everyone. I want it for these guys as well. And he gestures to everyone, but he stops his hand before he gestures over Sean Bean. You notice in that sequence? Really Let's interesting.
See, I never noticed that. That's interesting.
Yeah, he does. Or at least that's what I saw it as.
I like how it builds, like, De Niro's character's frustration with him. And he's obviously clocked instantly that not what he claims
to be. It's after he's writing things down on a newspaper when he talks to him initially. Mm. You can't really tell what he's writing, but it's almost like he's writing down little characterisms of these people. Sean gets up in the sequence and he goes over to this whiteboard and he goes, right, we're going to have here's the role, we're going to have a shooter here, shoot across. And De Niro gets up and he goes, wipes it all off, and he goes, do it again.
Yeah.
If this is your ambush, draw it again. And it really flusters Sean Bean. And then he goes, look, you know, if you do that, you've got shooters across from each other, they're going to shoot each other, kill each other dead. But they have this whole, he riles him up, he tells him to fuck off. And then he's put a cup of coffee down.
And he asks him what regiment he was with, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's it. He said, you know, 2-2 SAS. Yeah, set the start.
And Sean says that. And
what colour's the boat house at Hereford?
Yeah, Hereford.
Hereford, sorry, I think he says.
Hereford, yeah.
Hereford.
And that's apparently that's pronunciation of a lot of the Herefords in on the east coast of the US. So that's probably what
makes complete sense.
Yeah.
And then and then he riles him up so much he pushes him over with his cup of coffee and he grabs his pistol off of him and, you know, really sort of showing him up. And he goes, you're talking about an ambush? I ambushed you with a cup of coffee. It's just a great line.
It is.
It's a great little sequence.
There's a bit just after that as well where, you know, Skarsgård asks De Niro, what colour is the boathouse at Hereford?
Yeah.
And De Niro goes, how should I know? I love it. It's great.
Yeah, it's fab. Really great. Everyone's got good chemistry, and Sean Bean is used just enough in it. And I thought, is he going to become like the villain? You know, is he going to go and betray him or something? You never see him again. They were going to kill him off.
Yes.
But then they didn't want to.
Yeah. I think he's pretty underrated in this film because he's annoying because he's bullshit at the beginning and then he obviously turns out to be a fake and doesn't know what he's doing. But it's one of those moments where you have to remind yourself that you're thinking that about him because he's that good at playing this character. Mm. And Sean is portraying this on a level where you could think, oh, he's just being bullshit. But then that bullshiness is his nervousness coming through. And you can see, if you watch it, and you can see he's playing it nervous because he's realized he's in with all these guys who are professionals. And he knows that they're probably going to suss him, but he's still fronting. Like, you know, when he gets up, because he's not asked to get up and draw out the
No, they're not doing that, are they?
And he gets up and does it. And that, I just think it's a really nuanced, great performance from him.
Yeah, it is. And he, I like how after the initial firefight, he looks really ill and sick.
Yeah.
Like, I almost thought, is the character, is he taking, like, a sly bit of cocaine or heroin or something on the side to deal with it?
Yeah, yeah, you could read that out of that, yeah. And the jitteriness and stuff, yeah.
Mm, I thought
and,
that,
and
perhaps.
The poor choices he's making.
Yeah.
But, I mean, not, I mentioned...
Yeah. It's not ever hinted on, but I wondered that in my own head.
Yeah, well, I mentioned my headcanon earlier, and my, and because, obviously, De Niro's character, spoilers again, is later revealed to actually be still with the CIA, and he's hunting Seamus down, Jonathan Pryce's character. And it's probably hinted at that Jean Reno might be French intelligence or something like that, possibly. It's never revealed.
No. Heavily implied, though.
Yeah, exactly. And if you follow that, you know, through line, you could assume that if almost everyone on that team, except Gregor Skarsgård's character, was, you know, NATO Western intelligence. And Sean is probably like a low level MI6 agent, which has been, he's been pushed into this because he's the only guy available. He's the only guy that was available to like get to the meat of
when
they were going to be recruited. So he's been thrust into this. He's got no real experience with military stuff. And he, his cover stories is, you know, British Army, SAS. And those nerves are actually his nerves that he's worried he's going to get, you know, blown. So that was just something that occurred to me.
I like that.
I think you could read a lot into that character. I think that speaks to the way that Sean plays it.
And that's one of the great strengths of this movie, that everyone is worth exploring. Everyone's got skin in the game. I really like the characters. That's what makes the movie for me. Going forward.
One of my favorite scenes is that initial meeting of where they all meet, and it's the briefing, and they're all scoping each other out. You mentioned he's making notes on it on a newspaper. Renault asks him a question because he doesn't understand something that Deirdre has said. And, you know, De Niro replies in French. He's fluent. So you're learning all the time. Skarsgård, you know, has very good reflexes. You know, and you're learning little bits about each character. Even Larry's portrayed as, you know, he knows he wants an Audi S8. He knows what's going to be the right car for this job.
Mm-hmm.
And I love all the little questions that De Niro asks, like, are we going north? Are we going south? Are these guys going to be armed? How many of them are there? What's in the box? You know, what kind of resistance can we expect? What's in the box? Like, how many cars are there going to be? What's in the box? Like, there's all these questions that he asks, and she gives him the bare minimum and pushes back really right until they're well into the mission. And that sequence where that we, the subtleties of each of the characters comes out, and I really like that. One of my favorite scenes is that scene with the cup of coffee and the boathouse, and all of that comes to a pinnacle. And I love the way that De Niro's character just gets more and more frustrated. He's like, I can't believe this guy's, you know, trying to pretend to be as experienced as he says he is. And the way it comes to a head. But obviously we've talked about the chase scenes, but we've got to talk about the way that the convoy ambush ramps.
Oh, it's
because
great.
De Niro pops out of the car and he's armed with an HK 69, which is like a 40mm grenade launcher, like a blooper M72 from
Vietnam.
Yeah. And he hits the lead Citroen, and then pops back out with a SIG 551, which is like a 5.56 carbine, and he and Renault just pepper the other escort car.
Yeah,
the chase escalates. He ends up with a, you know, once they finally get to the car that has the briefcase in, you know, we mentioned it. He hops out with a mini me, and there's another part within the chase where he pops out the sunroof with a M72 Law. Kind of mocked up,
Yeah.
And it's just the way it staggers and stages.
You go, it's like Grand Theft Auto sort of weapon sort of leveling up, isn't it? You start with a lonely pistol, you end with a rocket launcher.
Yeah. It's been straight to ammunition at the beginning of the level.
Yeah, it is a film that feels like it could have had a game spin-off, like on the PS1 or something.
Mix
of Driver with, I don't know, like a third-person shooter. It would have been quite good.
Yeah, that would have been quite good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it does.
So, I think that takes us into final thoughts.
Nice, yeah. I mean, talking about, like, games there, for me, this movie, like, I'm not a big fan of those Fast and Furious films, really. I saw one in the cinema. No. I thought it was a bit of a joke, really. But the film predates... They have gotten worse, yeah. The film predates that series by 4 years, and I really feel like a film like Ronin could have held up a franchise. You could have had a different crew, but you could have still had De Niro in it, or you could have still had Jean Reno. They could have maybe been still hunting the briefcase. It could have fallen into a different hand. You could have done a sequel. I really think you could have. And because they do just enough well-building for you to want to know more. I have to ask a question to you, Matt. What's in the box? What's in the box?
Well, I mean, a lot of people say it's fissile material.
Yes. Like
radioactive nuclear material, but I don't know. Skarsgård's putting that through the French postal system. So
yeah, it's not.
You've got to wonder. I'm sure that at some point it's going to get clocked as being not the safest of cargoes.
Not safe. Because I read somewhere that people think it was on a website that we were looking at. Was people think it might have been printing plates for the euro that was just going to come online.
That was Auto Week. Yeah,
that was
Auto Week. It's like a car blog, wasn't it?
We
were reading around the car stuff just to make sure that we got all the car models correct. And yeah, they come up with a really interesting one where it suggests it's plates for the euro, which is interesting. Yeah,
I mean, I guess if you could get a drop on a new currency, you could have.
Yeah,
because they're IRA, aren't they? That's who they don't want this box to get into their hands of. So, would that have caused some sort of financial issues? Could they have purchased things with it? It's difficult to say what that would have been useful for. Obviously, printing money is useful, but
You would think that the euro would just go, you know what, we'll just change the plates.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Would just go, yeah, we can just change them.
Change the plates easily. Yeah,
yeah.
And then obviously,
so it's tricky to guess what it could be.
Yeah. So they asked. Frankenheimer, an interviewer called Bobby Wignant, sorry I'm pronouncing that wrong, but she asked him what's in the box, and he said it's a means
she's
to an end.
She's iconic. She's interviewed almost everyone.
That's it. Yeah, you know exactly who I'm talking about.
I know who you mean.
She's got there's a great database on YouTube of her interviews, and I do use a lot of them for the show when I can. And he said it's a means to an end. What we would have, could have put in would not have satisfied everybody. I think that's fair. And then he does also mention, and people were mentioning it on the Twitter, so I thought I'd clear it up if you're listening this far in. He said, so the tunnel they shot the chase sequence in was not the same tunnel that Princess Diana had her crash in. Because I know at the time, I think he mentions in the interview that people have been asking him since he was filming, but when they were filming it, they never thought of it. It never got mentioned.
That's a great sequence.
Yeah, very good sequence as well.
And apparently, like, Paris had a long time ban on allowing films to film action sequences like that, you know, with gunfire
and
like loud vehicles, purely for like sound ordinances. They weren't allowed to like have loud productions, which I think is really fascinating that Frankenheimer managed to navigate that bureaucracy.
Maybe they just thought that, you know, maybe his pedigree of France maybe might have helped.
So.
Yeah, MGM probably greased the wheels on that one, I guess.
Right.
But no, it's for my final thoughts really for Anniversary Month. I think it's been a fun month. I mean, I know not every film's been stellar, but it's been a fun month again. But it's a film, it's got great car chases, good villains. De Niro's always great to watch wherever he's in. And Frankenheim was just a master of this type of film. And it's if you like Heat, if you like Taxi, if you like the sort of late Renaissance sort of gold, not I wouldn't say Renaissance, but that sort of late 90s action. If you like a film like The Castle, this film will be for you. It's if you haven't already seen it, you know, I'm sure everyone listening has, but it's just a proper good film.
It's really solid. I suppose it doesn't quite fit the Mercenary Bill, but it's just in there.
No, they are mercenaries. Ronin is the definition at the start. It's a merc film.
It is, and I do like that part with Michael Lonsdale, where he's sort of talking De Niro through this, the concept of, you know, fallen samurai.
Yeah.
They've failed to protect their lord. 47 Ronin have to then kind of take revenge, and it's great. It's a great premise. I wish they'd actually, you know, they would make a decent film out of the actual story of the 47 Ronin, other than the really weird one with Keanu Reeves in.
Yeah, that wasn't fantastic.
Speaking of which, actually, there's a bit where De Niro gets shot through a Kevlar vest.
Oh, you didn't mention that in the Alex, did you?
Yeah, I completely forgot about that. And they go to Jean-Pierre's house, played by Michael Lonsdale, and John Renault Vincent pulls out the bullet from De Niro's side. It's gone through the vest, but the vest has slowed it down. And then he talks about it being a Teflon-coated bullet, which is a really interesting 90s kind of... It's not a trope. It's sort of like a phenomenon where it became a MacGuffin of its own, kind of. Because if you remember in like Lethal Weapon 3, it features, there's a cop killer bullet in there that penetrates armor. And it was something that was developed in the 90s. It's like a Teflon coating on bullets. But it wasn't really to make them any better at penetrating stuff. There was other reasons for it, you know, to protect the ammunition. It was to make it penetrate a little bit better through glass, actually, of all things. But there's a little sequence in there where it makes a mockery of all of, you know, the John Wick kind of bulletproof coats and stuff.
Yeah, oh God,
Where De Niro's taken a battering from this one round at relatively close range, where he's gone through the Kevlar and bruised him quite badly as well, because he sort of limps around for a bit. But then he's rolling around on the floor with.
But then they have that great sequence of Sean next sequence of surgery, which is great. Yeah,
it's great. Once they remove the bullet,
he's like, he has a really cool action. He sort of one liner where he goes, "Okay, and if you excuse me, I'm going to pass out now."
Yeah, I love it. Can you sew me up? Yeah, I think I'm going to pass out now.
Pass out is great. It's just fab, you know.
To conclude on my thoughts, I agree. It's a really solid piece. Frankenheimer knocks it out of the park with the direction. I think the cinematography is really nice. We've waxed lyrical on the chase sequences and the gunfights, and I think it all comes together into such a brilliant little package of an action movie.
Yeah.
And I'm glad it won. I'm glad it won the Patreon.
Oh no,
pick.
It did.
It resoundingly won the Patreon. Oh pick, God, but we had some good stuff in
80-20%.
Yeah, no, it was resounding.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been a fun one. I've enjoyed doing Mercenary Month 2. I mean, perhaps if everyone enjoyed it, let us know. We'll do a Mercenary Month 3 in another year or so.
I don't think I can give everyone a rest. Stomach one for another year. Yeah. Let me keep that
Mercenary May, Rob. Let's go.
Oh, crikey. No. No, but thanks for everyone.
It's been good fun.
Yeah, it's been good fun. Thanks everyone for sticking with us in Mercenary Month. We are back next week with a bit of a different episode, but we are still talking movies. Yeah. We're talking to the team who are from a film that you may or may not have heard of that's been doing the rounds on Twitter called A Memory Ode, which is a film about a Lancaster bomber crew in the Second World War. And they are currently trying to raise funding for their short film project, and we're talking to them about that and how you guys could get involved in making the film. It was a fantastic chat. So tune in next week for that one. Thanks for listening, everyone. You can catch the podcast in all the usual places, fightingonfilm.com for the back catalogue there. And just a quick bit of housekeeping before we go, if you're still listening, we're on Acast now, so you can find us on there. And I don't think anything else has been affected. You're still listening to us wherever you get your podcasts. Hopefully we're in your rotation. Give us a download, give us a share, a like if you're new from Acast. And we'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.